Good afternoon and welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals. Have all counsel checked in on our first two cases? Thank you. Have counsel received our written instructions and procedures? Any questions? Our first case is Boyer versus Golden Ridge. Our second case is Board of County Commissioners versus Rohrbach. We have a third case at 2:30. We will be taking a recess before that case to reconfigure the panel. On that basis, we're prepared to hear arguments in Boyer versus Golden Ridge. For people in the audience, if any of you has a cell phone or similar device, would you please turn it off so that the attorneys are not interrupted?
Good afternoon. My name is John McBride. I represent the plaintiff appellants in this case. In essence, the trial court dismissed all the claims, or most of the claims in this action, on the basis that they were compulsory counterclaims in post-judgment proceedings in a county court action, and were thus barred by the doctrines of res judicata. And essentially what the appeal addresses here is the relationship between compulsory counterclaims, res judicata, based upon actions that take place post-judgment to a lawsuit. And here, essentially what the trial court found and determined was that the actions that took place after a judgment was entered in the county court were, in which gave rise to claims by the plaintiffs in the district court, were essentially compulsory counterclaims and thus barred by the doctrine of res judicata.
Now, the law firm filed a motion to intervene.
That's correct.
Did the court ever order that as an intervener any counterclaims should be brought?
No.
Thank you.
My review of the record does not show that. And essentially, under the cases cited in our briefs, it is very, very clear, without almost undisputed the law in Colorado, is that any claims that arise post-firing of an action are not compulsory counterclaims. They are non-compulsory counterclaims, which allows under the law and the rules for a party to either bring them, I guess if they want, or to bring them in a separate action. And what the trial court failed to recognize is that if the counterclaims, non-compulsory counterclaims arising post-judgment based upon actions that occurred post-judgment, the county court action, are not compulsory counterclaims, they cannot be res judicata. Because if that's the case, then they're absolutely compulsory counterclaims, and that's not the law in Colorado. You can't have it both ways. Either they're non-compulsory counterclaims, and you can bring them in an independent action, and thus they are not barred by the doctrine of res judicata, or they are compulsory counterclaims, and thus subject to the doctrine of res judicata. And the cases in our briefs are uniform in holding that any claims, related or unrelated to the claims being litigated, are not compulsory counterclaims in an action if they accrue post-filing of the action, and thus could be, but don't need to be, litigated in that action.
Let me ask you this. Would res judicata bar any claim that could be but not need be litigated in the first action?
No, because
that could have been raised.
It makes no sense, because basically you're saying, if you say that, well, res judicata bars non-compulsory counterclaims, then they're compulsory counterclaims. It can't be both ways. Either you can bring them, or you cannot. And if they're counterclaims, non-compulsory, claims accruing post-filing of the action, they can be brought, the law in Colorado said they can be brought separately. You can bring them separately. So if you can do that, they can't be barred by res judicata, because there would be a conflict between the two doctrines.
The essential issue, as you're arguing it, is that these claims arose only after the judgment in the initial case.
Oh, that's exactly right.
And so the claims didn't even exist. They were neither compulsory nor permissive. You couldn't bring them because you would have no cause of action.
They had not accrued at the time the judgment was entered in the county court.
And so the accrual, as in your analysis, is when?
They accrued at the time that the writs of garnishment were served upon the plaintiffs, and basically required by court order that the plaintiffs pay some sum of money to the judgment creditor.
And what was the essential dispute in the underlying case?
The underlying case, there wasn't really much of a dispute. Basically, Ms. Boyer failed to pay her association dues for some period of time. I'm not sure what time. And then they filed a lawsuit. She caught up. They got a judgment. And then they got a judgment for $4,000 and $5,000, whatever it was, and then garnished her wages for that amount when all the monies had been paid. But, you know, whether or not that states a claim for wrongful garnishment wasn't before the trial court. The trial court dismissed on the basis, basically, res judicata, compulsory counterclaims.
And the garnishment problem could not have been raised because no garnishment had been initiated.
The garnishment problem could not have been raised in the trial court during the proceedings that led to the judgment. It just had not happened.
Was the issue in the garnishment simply that there was no longer a debt?
Correct.
Well, couldn't that have been raised in the initial proceeding, that there was no debt?
What happened was that in the original proceeding, a judgment was entered, and for some amount. And I don't think it's material to the issues raised here, but what happened was that in the interim between the December, I think it was December, it was filed, January, judgment was entered, all the amounts were paid, or most of the amounts were paid, and then in April, I believe, a writ of garnishment for the full amount was served, although Ms. Boyer did not owe anything anymore.
Okay, so at the time of the initial proceeding, there certainly was a debt. The adjudication was appropriate that there was a debt. Thereafter, the debt was satisfied, and thereafter, the garnishment proceedings were initiated, notwithstanding the fact that the debt was satisfied.
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
As a kind of minor point, also to be a compulsory counterclaim, there has to be a logical relationship test. And clearly it's not met here. You're talking about, as we were just talking about, you're talking about, on one hand, a debt for association dues that has no relation whatsoever to a service of writ of garnishment after a judgment entered. But the main point is that essentially the law in Colorado, as set forth in the briefs we filed, is that if you have a cause of action and it accrues after a lawsuit is filed against a party to that lawsuit, or everyone's parties to that lawsuit, it is not a compulsory counterclaim. And the adjudication of the first suit cannot be raised judicata to a claim that accrued after that lawsuit was filed, and where it is not a compulsory counterclaim. And that is where the trial court erred. I will save my remaining 5.5 minutes for rebuttal, if that's okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm John Lebsack, and I represent the Golden Ridge Condominium Association, which is the defendant in the case. I submit that the issue in this case is whether res judicata applies generally to all cases, including those that take a somewhat unconventional route through the court, as well as cases that take the classic path through the court according to the rules.
Counsel, before you do the res judicata argument, it would, and I'm just confused about the procedure, it would appear that the plaintiff moved for summary judgment on its abusive process counterclaim. The defendant opposed that motion, but didn't ask that the claim be dismissed, but nevertheless, the trial court dismissed the abusive process claim with prejudice based on the way it had been pleaded. Is
correct.
That accurate?
Yes. I have some notes on that. Could I get those?
Absolutely. So if that's essentially accurate procedurally, my question is, how could the abusive process claim be dismissed with prejudice as opposed to with leave to replead if the only summary judgment record was based on the way it had been pled, and as opposed to, you know, factual information being put in that the claim was deficient?
There was one motion that was granted. There were three orders, and you're correct. The one that was granted on abusive process, which was the first claim, in our response, we did not ask for summary judgment. The other one,
or dismissal.
We asked for, I mean, if you read strictly what we said, we asked for the plaintiff's motion to be denied and such are the relief as the court deems just.
Well, how in that setting, how could the court possibly dismiss it with prejudice?
I believe sua sponte, the court could address the flaw in the claim of abusive process that it didn't allege an ulterior motive.
Okay, but isn't that essentially a 12B pleading standard that would be dismissal, you know, with leave to replead rather than with prejudice?
Yes, I'll agree to that point.
Okay, well then go ahead.
I think that's harmless error.
Okay, go ahead with your res judicata.
If that was error, that was harmless error because the court clearly applied res judicata to dismiss all claims, and that would have included the abusive process claim if it had not already been dismissed.
Okay, I apologize for diverting.
That's okay.
Go ahead with your res judicata argument.
In this case, I mean, let me just contrast this case with the standard case. The standard case, which you know, we're all familiar with, is a set of facts gets reflected in a complaint. The defendant responds to the complaint with an answer, perhaps a counterclaim. Those issues are resolved, and then a judgment is entered that encapsulates all those proceedings, and you have a judgment. In this case, what happened was much different, but the issues got addressed eventually, just in a different format. What happened here was a complaint was filed. Default was entered. An answer was filed, but the answer was not brought to the court's attention either because it was not filed on time, it appears that it was a few hours late, and it had the wrong case number. Whatever. Default judgment was entered. So the issue of liability was never resolved. The issue of the debt, the responsibility for the debt, was never resolved at that stage. So we're not saying that res judicata kicked in at that stage. That's not at all what we're saying. The answer did not include a counterclaim, and obviously it could not have a counterclaim as to the garnishment because the garnishment was 6 months in the future.
Would you explain how the default judgment did not resolve the question of the existence of the debt?
Because the parties and the county court magistrate addressed that issue through motions to amend and modify the judgment. So the issue of what Ms. Boyer owed the association was not resolved based on the complaint and the answer. It was resolved in motions to modify the judgment, motions to strike the garnishment, motions that were filed after the garnishment. So our position on when res judicata kicked in is not from when the original answer was filed, but you have to, we believe, focus on the period after the garnishment and after all those issues were brought to the county court's attention in the forms of motions to modify the judgment, motions to strike the garnishment.
Have you found any case anywhere that treats a cause of action that accrues post-judgment, which I think you acknowledge, as a compulsory counterclaim for purposes of res judicata?
No.
Have you found any case anywhere that treats, that applies this res judicata analysis to a party who intervenes post-judgment?
No.
Thank you.
Let me first address the issue of how the Zadro entities are affected by res judicata. And there are three entities. I'll just collectively call them Zadro. Those entities moved to intervene. The motion was granted. They did not actually file a pleading of any kind. However, it's clear from the motion that they intended to do that. The motion to intervene says Zadro files a motion to defend itself against slanderous, malicious, baseless, groundless, vexatious claims. Intervener reserves all of its claims to be presented when allowed by the court.
Now, did the court ever enter an order specifically either directing or affirmatively allowing Zadro as an intervener to bring claims?
No. The record is silent on that point. But what we can gain some information from is what happened at the hearing on September 12th. There's nothing in the paper file that shows that Zadro actually pursued a claim. All that we know is that a hearing was held, a motions hearing was held on September 12th. And at the conclusion of that, an order was entered. We have the order. We don't have a transcript of that hearing. All we know is what was entered, and we can deduce from that order what proceedings took place. At that order, in the order, it says the claims by Zadro are dismissed. So we can deduce from that at the hearing, whatever claims were reserved were waived, were abandoned in some way. So our position on res judicata.
Excuse me, this is a hearing in county court.
In county court.
Of which there's no transcript.
Of which there's no transcript, and I believe none is available. Okay. The clerk in Jefferson County advised me that they destroy tapes after 2 years. This is based on a phone conversation, so I'm not being definitive, but I looked into it. So it's not in the record, the transcript, but what we have is the order, and it's a two-page order on the various motions. So as to Zadro, we submit that res judicata applied because the motion to intervene said we reserve all claims to be asserted, and they referred to slander and malicious and baseless claims, which refers to the garnishment. That's the only reason that Zadro was involved here, was because it was served with the garnishment papers. And then that happened in April. There were other motions filed at the same time, and those were heard on September 12th. And we have that order, which I submit is the key document in the record. It is absolutely the key document because it drives res judicata as to all the plaintiffs. As to Zadro, it shows that those claims that they had moved to intervene to pursue were dismissed.
How could they be dismissed if they were never pleaded?
They were not pleaded.
Okay, well then how can a court, I mean, forgetting whether it be with or without prejudice, which I gather the order you're referencing is silent as to whether the dismissal was with or without prejudice.
The order just says Zadro is dismissed.
Does it say Zadro's claims are dismissed, or does it just say Zadro is dismissed from the case?
It says, and this is Exhibit F to the complaint, page 2, the court dismisses all of the corporate entities named as interveners, garnishees, and/or alleged employers, to wit, Zadro.
Okay, now, I apologize if I misunderstood. I thought earlier you were telling us that the court dismissed claims by Zadro.
That's what I believe this means.
Okay, but it doesn't refer to claims.
It does not mention claims.
And there's no pleading or other document in the file indicating that Zadro made any claims.
Correct.
Okay.
All that we have is the motion to intervene, in which they state that they were reserving claims, a motions hearing on all pending motions, and at the conclusion of that, the court dismisses the corporate entities. So our position is that res judicata applies to those claims that were reserved, and then when the party was dismissed, that's res judicata as to those claims. There is no pleading that says that, but I think applying what the doctrine is intended to protect against, it should apply here. Now, as to Ms. Boyer, the res judicata also applies and derives from that same order. And it's the next, two paragraphs after that. What had happened by this time, and let me just back up, was that the previous December default judgment had been entered. The garnishment was issued in March. Motions were filed in April by Ms. Boyer and Zadro, her counsel and her employer. And then those motions ended up being heard on September 12th. The issue of how much was owed, was this calculated properly? Was the amount on the garnishment wrong or was it right? Did it incorrectly say that she hadn't made any payments? All those issues were wrapped up in that hearing and were resolved in the final paragraph of the order, where the court basically said, plaintiff and defendant, you get together and you try to figure out what the correct amount is. The judgment is going to be modified to reflect that, if you can work it out. And if you can't work it out, defendant shall call the court after 30 days. If you can't work it out within 30 days, defendant's supposed to call the court and set this matter for a hearing. So the issue of how much was owed, the entire issue of what the financial relationship was between Ms. Boyer and the association, the court directed the parties to try to work it out voluntarily, and if they couldn't, then the court would have a hearing to resolve that. So that was, in effect, the opportunity and the forum whereby Ms. Boyer could bring all these issues for a decision.
I mean, how do you read into that order, leave for Ms. Boyer to bring a counterclaim in a case that had already been reduced to judgment? I mean, wouldn't the court first have to set aside the judgment, second, allow her to answer, and third, allow her to file a counterclaim?
I agree that this case did not follow the classic course. And normally that would be the course that it would take. But in this case, the court resolved issues. And I don't think res judicata means we only will apply issues that are resolved the way they normally are. I think res judicata should apply if that same basic issue is resolved, but it's not resolved in the same manner. So
okay,
what
well,
the court?
How does the resolution of a dispute over the amount of the judgment equal a resolution of counterclaims or claims that she may have for wrongful garnishment?
Because by this time, all the garnishment events had taken place. So if she had some claim that she didn't owe money, the association actually owed her money. That was her opportunity to do that. And she had a vehicle for that by the court expressly saying, I'll set it down for a hearing. Now, the parties eventually didn't do that. They signed a stipulation as to the correct amount of the judgment, and they signed a satisfaction of judgment. So it didn't go into that route of having the court decide.
So the judgment was never set aside?
The judgment was later set aside.
Okay, then that confuses me a little bit.
Right. And
how can you later set aside a judgment that's been satisfied?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. It's the unorthodox way that this this case proceeded through the court. There was a default judgment. In September, the court said, no further collection efforts, stop. Garnishment is set aside. And don't collect further on this. Sit down and try to work out what, you know, do an accounting. And then if you can't work it out, we'll have a hearing. So they worked it out and signed the stipulation and filed it in January of 2007. And then the next thing that happens in the court record is a motion to vacate the default that had originally been entered, and that was granted. So it had already been satisfied. So we believe res judicata applies. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that the counsel for the association makes way too much of this hearing. Essentially, what occurred is that the county court judge said, okay, you have to satisfy or get have a judgment entered and get it satisfied. And if you guys can't work it out, you'll come back into my courtroom and I'll work it out. And the only issue that the county court addressed to the parties at that point was how to decide upon amount of judgment and how much would have to be paid by Ms. Boyer to satisfy the judgment.
Were you representing Ms. Boyer at this time?
I was not.
You were not?
I was not.
Okay. Was she represented?
Yes, she was.
Okay.
And this was not the county court judge's direction to say, I want you all to sit down and resolve all claims, whatever they may be, between the two of you, which, at least in my mind, would require that somebody, if they have a claim, file something akin to a complaint with the county court and have the other party file something akin to an answer with the county court over whether or not the garnishment was wrongful and whether or not Ms. Boyer and Zadro incurred damages, and then have a full-blown trial for the damages claim for wrongful garnishment. And certainly what the county court was not doing was telling the parties to sit down, figure out all the claims you have outstanding as of this day, get them resolved, and you can't come back here and we'll have a trial on whatever's out there. It's very important, I believe, that this case, that you remember that this case is about whether the claims had to be brought post-judgment in the county court action or they were barred. It's not about when they could have been brought or how they could have been brought. The issue is whether or not they had to be brought in the county court after judgment was entered and after there was no more issues really to be resolved in terms of liability and damages. Could they have filed something in the county court action in terms of the counterclaim afterwards? I don't know. That's not the issue. The issue is whether they had to, and the law is clear that they did not. Unless you have any questions, I am not.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel in what is certainly an unconventional case, I guess, as both sides agree.